Today is Wednesday, May 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Just ahead, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to Russia Tuesday.
The United States stands ready to find common ground with Russia as long as the two of us can engage seriously on those issues.
Also, U.S. President Donald Trump has not ruled out deploying a lot more soldiers to Iran. What could be done to safeguard your mobile devices from malicious attacks? And an American comedic icon sadly passes. Those stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Sochi, Russia on Tuesday. The secretary highlighted the Trump administration's goal of the talks when he spoke during a press conference.
President Trump's made clear that his expectation is that we will have an improved relationship between our two countries. This will benefit each of our peoples, and I think that our talks here today were a good step in that direction.
Lavrov said he expected a sincere conversation with Pompeo, including trying to find out how the Trump administration planned to resolve tensions with Iran. To get a broader picture of the day's events, I spoke with VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain a little bit earlier. So Secretary Pompeo met both with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian President Vladimir Putin. What did they discuss?
Well, it was a whole range of issues, including what a lot of the world is paying attention to right now with Iran, with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov rather bluntly saying that he hoped that rumors that the U.S. might be sending 120,000 additional troops to the Middle East, that was just a rumor, and he said that Pompeo had told him that it was. And Pompeo only said that the U.S. Does not want war with Iran, but would defend itself. So they talked about Iran, they talked about Syria and North Korea, and of course the subject of Russian interference in the U.S. elections also came up.
Well, since the 2020 election, really the election cycle is full underswing here, we got 22 Democratic candidates right now. What was the conversation about the election?
Well, it was interesting because President Putin went on offense, so to speak, and saying that both he and President Trump really want to rebuild U.S.-Russian relations. And Putin even mentioned the Mueller report, saying that it was very objective and it had proven that, in his words, there was no collusion. Of course, the Mueller report actually said that Russia systematically interfered in U.S. elections. So, when Secretary Pompeo did have the press conference with Foreign Minister Lavrov, he said that he had cautioned the Russians that if they interfered again in 2020, that bilateral relations would be in even a worse place and that this was unacceptable.
Pompeo, in his remarks, also said that there were some differences of opinions on policy matters between the United States and Russia, for example, like Venezuela. And he also mentioned that he wanted to try and find some common ground between the two countries. Did he give any inkling as to how Washington and Moscow are going to try and find a way to come together someplace in the middle on such a divergent topic as Venezuela?
Not really. And then I thought that Pompeo was rather blunt and honest about that, saying we disagree. And he said that the U.S. and some 50 other countries think it's time for Maduro to leave, that the Venezuelan people have suffered enough. But the Russian foreign minister said that basically it's not democracy when other countries are intervening, and then went back and gave a little history lesson on where he thought that the U.S. had intervened in Libya and other countries. So that, like as you said, I'm not quite sure how they will find common ground on that, but they did say that they will keep talking on that and a number of other issues.
Did the subject of Ukraine come up at all in their discussions?
It did. I think that I heard Secretary Pompeo again say that the U.S. would not accept the annexation of Crimea. This is always it didn't get a lot of attention, but one can hear kind of between the lines that it is still a sore point between the two.
And you also mentioned that they brought up the subject of North Korea. Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, just met recently with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. What can you tell us about that portion of the conversation?
Right, right. Well, Foreign Minister Lavrov said that that they had had good discussions, and also mentioned that Putin's meeting with Kim Jong-un, and said that Russia is for the denuclearization of the entire peninsula. So that was an interesting aspect, and it's sort of putting it into a broader context and broader terms.
That was VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Same. Sudan's ruling military council said at least five protesters and an army major were shot dead Monday night in the capital of Khartoum. The deaths occurred just hours after they reached a deal with protest leaders on a transitional authority. Jason Patinkin brings us that report.
Gunfire in the heart of Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Armed men in uniform fired in the air and at protesters at an ongoing mass sit-in Monday night, killing several and wounding dozens. Sudan's Transitional Military Council blamed unidentified elements for the attack and said one military police officer, an army major, was among the victims. But it was unclear who was responsible for the shooting. Yasser Mohammed, a lawyer, spoke to VOA after fleeing gunfire on Nile Street just before midnight. He said, unfortunately, they can't say who attacked them. But from what he's seen and experienced, said Mohammed, it was likely shadow soldiers in the Secret Service who caused this massacre. Sudan's army has defended protesters against previous attacks on their weeks-long demonstration for civilian rule. But there are also military police, national security services, and a heavily armed Darfuri militia, the Rapid Support Forces, linked to ousted President Omar al-Bashir. Adding confusion is the belief among protesters that these various groups may be wearing each other's uniforms. Those with gunshot wounds were taken to nearby hospitals. But in a field clinic set up by protesters, dozens of wounded streamed in as gunfire crackled outside. Many suffered from tear gas that security forces fired at protesters. Others had head wounds and said they were beaten. Yusuf Al-Sayer said a member of the Rapid Support Forces, who was in uniform, beat him on Nile Street. He said, gunfire is usually normal, but people started running and Rapid Support Forces started coming under the bridge. I tried to hide since I have a disability and can't run, said Al-Sayer, but an RSF soldier started beating me. I yelled, I'm hurt, he said. But the soldier didn't listen and just kept beating. The violence came as a surprise, as the ruling military council has been in talks with protest leaders for the past few weeks on forming an interim government. But the field clinic's Dr. Iman El-Tihani said the situation appears to be escalating.
The first few days of the sit-in, there was a lot of violence, to be honest, from the forces. And then there was a stillness or a calmness afterwards for almost a little less than a month. And now recently, especially today and yesterday, there's been like some sort of a relapse into the violence.
Monday night's violence seemed timed to upset progress in talks between Sudan's military and protest leaders on a transitional authority. The attacks came just hours after the military council announced they had reached a deal. Sudan's prosecutor general's office had also declared former President Omar al-Bashir had been charged over the killings of protesters. The military took power after ousting al-Bashir on April 11th from 3 decades of rule. The coup followed 4 months of anti-government protests, sparked by fuel and food shortages in which dozens were killed in clashes with security forces. Protesters erected barricades and blocked roads around Sudan's defense ministry, where they have been ever since demanding the military hand power to civilians. The funeral procession on Monday night carried the body of one of the killed protesters. The military council and protest leaders have said the violence will not stop them from forming a transitional government before holding elections. But with attacks on them increasing, protesters have to figure out which troops are with them and which are against them. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Khartoum.
U.S. President Donald Trump has rejected a report that he is considering sending 120,000 troops to counter Iran, but didn't rule out deploying a lot more soldiers in the future. VOA's Carla Babb has that story.
A show of force and a clear signal to Iran. A Patriot missile battery and the USS Arlington will join four B-52 bombers and the massive USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier strike group. Commanders requested all of this extra power after intelligence picked up potential Iranian threats on land and sea against American forces in the region.
It's important that Iran understand that an attack on Americans or its interests will be met with an appropriate response.
The threats included commercial vessels that Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps had loaded with military hardware to include missiles, according to a senior military official. But a senior counter-Islamic State coalition officer told a different tale.
Have you seen any threat indications?
No, there's been no increased threat from Iranian-backed forces in Iraq and Syria.
After the briefing, the U.S. military said recent comments from the coalition's deputy commander run counter to the identified credible threats available to intelligence from U.S. and allies regarding Iranian-backed forces in the region. All service members assigned in Iraq and Syria are now on high alert.
If we can find some very limited way to respond, I think we will and I think we should. But if we overdo it, we could be on the path to war.
Officials say the United States does not want war, but it will protect American forces. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Here are other stories around the globe. British Prime Minister Theresa May will try again next month to secure Parliament's backing for a Brexit deal so that the UK can leave the European Union this summer. Sri Lankan police arrested 23 people on Tuesday in connection with a spate of attacks on Muslim-owned homes and shops and apparent reprisal for the Easter bombings by Islamist militants that killed more than 250 people. A powerful magnitude 7.5 earthquake rattled the coastal townships in Papua New Guinea late Tuesday. Authorities are assessing the damage. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study in the journal Science suggests there may be very few small Kuiper Belt objects. The Kuiper Belt is an almost 3 billion kilometer wide ring of rocks left over from the creation of the solar system. A Southwest Research Institute-led team of scientists studied photos and data captured during the 2015 flyby of Pluto and its largest moon, Charon, by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft. Their analysis revealed that a lack of craters measuring between 91 meters to 1.6 kilometers on Charon must also indicate that any impacting objects smaller than that may also be rare. The study's lead author, Kelsey Singer of the SWRI, said that a lack of small Kuiper Belt objects indicates the formation and or evolution of the Kuiper Belt were somewhat different than the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Donald Trump is denying trade talks with China have collapsed and is characterizing what many are calling a trade war between the world's two largest economies as a little squabble.
We have a very good dialogue. We have a dialogue going. It'll always continue. But we made a deal with China. It was a deal that was a very good deal. It had to be a good deal. Otherwise, we're not making it because we've been down so low in trade. Another president should have done this a long time ago. We can't just make a good deal. And I told that to President Xi. But we had a deal that was very close, and then they broke it. They really did. I mean, more than renegotiate, they really broke it. So we can't have that happen.
As a result, administration officials say the president this week decided to deepen what they bluntly characterize as a trade war with China. And while entering into a tit-for-tat exchange with Beijing may not be ideal, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell remained positive.
Well, one thing I think we all agree on is that nobody wins a trade war. And we're all hoping, as others have suggested here, that these particular tactics get us into a better position vis-a-vis China, which has been our worst and most unfair trading relationship for a very long time.
At a time when political division in Washington is as wide as any time in recent memory, there is a surprisingly high degree of bipartisanship confronting Beijing. The Senate's top Democrat, Chuck Schumer of New York.
China is rapacious. I've been saying that since 2003. We have to have tough, strong policies against China, or they'll continue to steal millions of American jobs and trillions of American dollars. I believe that we should aim things at China. All the tariff fights with Canada, Mexico, Europe, Japan make no sense. We ought to all be united and aimed at China, and I think we'd come to a very good solution quickly.
Trump on Tuesday defended the tariffs he imposed last week on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, but he said nothing about Monday's 2.4% stock market plunge after China countered Trump's levies by announcing June 1st tariff increases on $60 billion worth of U.S. exports. Trump departs from conventional economics on trade in at least three ways. He has repeatedly claimed that the Chinese, not Americans, are paying the 25% tariff he has imposed on the $250 billion U.S. dollars of Chinese imports. He has described the trade deficit that the United States runs with other individual countries as total economic losses, and he argues that the U.S. trade deficit with all other countries combined is a result of bad trade policies. On all three questions, trade experts fundamentally disagree. President Trump is scheduled to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the Group of 20 leaders meeting in Osaka, Japan in late June, but there are little consensus that by experts that a deal can be reached by the end of the year. North Korea accused the United States of robbery on Tuesday and demanded the immediate return of a cargo ship seized for allegedly violating international sanctions. Earlier, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo to learn more. North Korea finally came out and commented on the seizure of the Wise Honest on Tuesday. What exactly did they have to say about the seizure of the vessel?
Well, they were quite firm in that they called it a robbery and demanded the immediate return of the ship. As you mentioned, this was the first public comment from North Korea on this seizure, and nobody really knew what to expect. And while those words are firm, they're perhaps not as firm as they could have been, given that this is North Korean state media, and sometimes they can be quite colorful in their language. There was a warning of some kind of unspecified consequences, but there was no real specific threat associated with that.
Is there any significance to the seizure of the Wise Honest?
Well, I mean, so the timing of this is interesting. The ship was actually seized last year in April by Indonesian authorities. So this wasn't like seized last week. It was just announced that the U.S. had taken over the ship last week, which I think there is some significance to that timing in that it came right after these latest North Korean missile launches. Also, it could be seen as part of a U.S. effort to impose a maximum pressure campaign on North Korea and to sort of tighten the sanctions pressure on North Korea.
That was VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. Messaging application WhatsApp said on Tuesday that a security breach had signs of coming from a government using surveillance technology developed by a private company and may have targeted human rights groups. WhatsApp, which is part of Facebook, said it had notified the U.S. Department of Justice to help with an investigation and encouraged all WhatsApp users to update to the latest version of the app where the breach has been fixed. Now, to learn more about the vulnerability and malicious attacks on mobile platforms, I spoke with Ian Ahmet, Chief Security Officer with the firm Simpress. We started our conversation with Ahmet explaining what happened with WhatsApp.
What's happening here is that this company called NSO has found or developed an exploit or a vulnerability for WhatsApp that enables it to, without any user interaction, install a Trojan or a spyware onto the user's phone, regardless if it's an iOS, Apple iPhone, or an Android one.
And what does the Trojan enable the perpetrator to do?
Specifically for NSO, whose main product is called Pegasus, that Trojan basically enables full control over the phone. It enables the attacker to tap into any conversation, to record audio, video, to get GPS coordinates, to snoop on any kind of user activity, to access any kind of anything basically over on that phone.
Is that only while the application is active? In sense, in use, because a lot of times you'll start WhatsApp or any application on your phone, and it kind of goes into the background. Would it still be sending that kind of transmission data then?
So Pegasus operates nonstop. It operates regardless of what application you're currently using as a user. The key for this exploit is that you don't even have to open WhatsApp. The exploit is triggered through a call, an incoming call, to the WhatsApp application on your phone, which, again, if you have it installed, it's going to trigger, regardless if you're using it right now or not.
So how can consumers really protect themselves? Because if I think about my home computers at home, I have a virus protection software. When I travel and I am using an unsecure network, I have a VPN to kind of shield me from that. You know, I know not to click on suspicious links and email. But like you said, if I have the app on my phone, someone has my contact information, a call comes in, I'm vulnerable. I mean, this is an app on the phone. How can users protect themselves?
That's actually a great question. So I'll actually address my answer in two different aspects. Mm-hmm. From a practical perspective, there isn't really a way to protect yourself. And this is really the meaning of a zero day, as we call it in the security industry. That means that this exploit or this vulnerability does not have any patch to protect the user from it. And you know, it doesn't matter if you have any. Even if you have some sort of
when you say there's no patch for this, you're talking about this kind of attack rather than this specific incident.
Yeah, exactly. This specific type of attack for a vulnerability that has not been disclosed to anyone. So even if, let's say that you do have some form of the equivalent of antivirus on your phone, that antivirus still doesn't know how to look for this kind of attack. So that's the bad news, so to speak, from a user perspective. There really isn't a way to protect yourself from it. The next best thing that users can do is be diligent about updating their applications, updating their operating systems. Apple came out with a patch for iOS today, as well as WhatsApp, of course. So that's the bad news from a user perspective. The flip side, and the sort of good news, again, with caveats, is that NSO and specifically its customers are less likely to target the masked up population. You know, we're not talking about something that's going to run around and just, you know, be used as a mass hacking tool. That this specific exploit and this specific vulnerability is usually used to target very specific individuals. NSO boasts that it is only used for lawful interception and is working with law enforcement. However, the flip side is that it's been proven before that that we've seen NSO customers using those kind of applications, Pegasus and the like, to also target other populations, from civil rights activists to journalists. So again, as I said, that's kind of the good news with a caveat that there's no guarantees that only bad guys, quote unquote, are going to be targeted by companies like NSO.
That was Simpress Chief Security Officer Ian Ahmet, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Even though you hear a lot about human beings moving into space permanently, well, you know, there's only about three humans in space at any given time, and they're up on the International Space Station, but they happen to be very, very busy. But you know what? They just got some robotic help from NASA, and VOA's Kevin Enox has that report.
These are the Astro Bees. Currently, there are three of them, named Honey, Queen, and Bumble. Two of them recently arrived in space and will soon be a part of the crew of the International Space Station.
So we have two robots, Honey and Bumble, are now on orbit. And just last week, we had our first checkout activity where Anne McClain, one of the astronauts on orbit, unpacked and turned on and checked out Bumble. So Bumble is alive and well.
They are taking over from the Spheres, which were an earlier form of robot helpers on the ISS. The Astro Bees have cameras and microphones on board, and during the next few months, project manager Maria Boilet says they will be learning their way around the ISS.
Where we're going to calibrate the cameras on board and do a mapping activity where the astronaut will manually fly the robot back and forth across the Japanese experiment module to collect imagery data that we'll use to build a map of the GEM, the Japanese experiment module.
Once they have an internal map, the Astro Bees will be able to find their way around the ISS on their own and begin doing some heavy lifting.
We want to turn these into workhorses. We want to free up astronaut time to let the crew do things that really only humans can do. And there's a saying in robotics in general, the 3Ds, dirty, dangerous, and dull, right? Those are the things that you want a robot to do rather than have a human do.
The Astro Bee also has a lot of room for experiments, and middle and high schoolers around the country are already competing to get some of theirs on board. The Astro Bee's docking module has already been installed, and the tiny indoor satellites will begin making their first voyages sometime in June. Kevin Enox, VOA News.
Emmy-winning actor Tim Conway, who brought an endearing, freewheeling goofiness to skits on The Carol Burnett Show that cracked up his castmates as well as the audience, has died on Tuesday, May 14th at the age of 85. Conway won three Emmy Awards for acting on The Burnett Show and a fourth as a writer in the 1960s and 70s. He had this to say about Carol Burnett in 2007.
A wonderful sense of humor, a wonderful, generous heart as she lives life the way people should live it. She just enjoys people, enjoys living, enjoys doing a lot of things for people. And that show never would have been that successful if it weren't for her, because she was a star who let you do things. And most people, if something funny comes up and they're the star of the show, say, I'll be doing that. But she just let us do whatever we wanted.
Burnett said in a 2003 interview with the Television Academy Foundation that nobody could be with Tim and keep a straight face once he got on a roll. And today, actor Joel McHale had this to say about Conway.
He is one of those guys, one of the pioneers of modern American comedy. And that Carol Burnett Show with Harvey Korman and him, there was some of the finest moments in American television.
Actor Tim Conway dead at the age of 85. And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can take our stories with you with our VOA mobile application. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a wonderful Wednesday.
This is VOA News. I'm